on our bus. So as Robert said last time, I'll be giving some lectures on nonlinear PDE. On Thursdays, and the idea is to that I give some talks on nonlinear PDE, and in particular the PDE that will tie in with optimal transport. So that's the Monge-Ampere equation in particular. Now I don't know how much background you people have in partial differential equations, so I'm not going to assume much at all. What we will need, I will state shortly, and if you haven't seen that before, it doesn't really matter. You'll pick it up as you go along. Some of it you'll pick up if you're also going to Walter Craig's course. Some of it you'll do there. So I don't want to spend much time on the really more elementary PDE. I want to move on to the more interesting nonlinear theory as soon as is reasonably possible. Okay. So let me just start by, well, maybe I should tell you where you can find me. I'm in room 414, and I have a phone number as well, and it's whatever the Fields Institute number is, which I can never remember, and then it's an extension. I think it's 4014. And email. fields.utoronto.ca. I will also try to write some notes on this topic. I have some notes from previous lectures I've given, so I'm sort of using this as an opportunity to clean them up a bit. So I'm not sure whether I'll hand those out or I'll put them on the web or something, but there will be notes possibly by next week. Not for the whole course yet, but for the first couple of lectures. So anyway, so what we're looking at in this course, nonlinear partial differential equation. So what I have in mind here is a partial differential equation which looks like this. It's some function of x, which is x is the variable in some domain in Rn, so usually omega will be a bounded open set, usually also connected. And the partial differential equation is some function of x, the unknown function u, its gradient du, and its Hessian. The Hessian is the matrix of second derivatives, and this is equal to zero in the domain omega. Okay, that's a second order nonlinear partial differential equation, a relation like that. So, is anyone here who hasn't done a course in PDE before? Sorry? So, who hasn't done a course before? Okay, but most of you have probably seen things like Laplacian. Most of you have seen some sort of, you've done Laplace's equation probably, and seen things like the maximum principle. Yes. Anyway, so let's start with some examples. So the very simplest example is Laplace's equation, Laplacian u equal to zero, where Laplacian is just the sum of pure second derivatives, and that's about the simplest second order PDE there is. We could also look at the inhomogeneous one, where we have some function of x on the right hand side. Okay, so these are a linear in that the second derivatives, or the derivative u and u, well, they don't, these two don't occur, only second derivatives occur, but they occur in a linear way. So it's a linear equation here. And then we could look at more general things where we have some matrix Aij and let's say Aij is symmetric. So that would be the this is a general second order linear PDE. Okay. And in this subject, there are usually a lot of subscripts and superscripts. usually, we write it in this way, but what is really meant here is a sum over I and j from 1 equal to n. Okay, that's what really is meant. But usually we drop this out and the summation is understood. Okay, so from now on, unless I particularly want to emphasize that it's summed, I will drop out. I'll leave out these sums. Okay, okay, so that's the general second order linear PDE. So you get Laplace's equation you just take that to be the delta ij identity matrix and bi and c equal to zero. Okay, now at this point we have to impose some more restrictions on what sort of equations we're going to look at. So let me make a definition now. So let me call this equation, let's say 1. 1 is elliptic if Aij, so this matrix, is positive definite. In omega. Okay, and in this course I will talk about elliptic equations only. The reason is that that's mostly what I know about, and if you want to deal with things which are non-elliptic, the theory can be very different, right? So, for example, if you take Aij to be, say, diagonal matrix minus 1, 1, then you get the equation minus u minus d 1, 1 u plus which, if you decide to call the first variable the t variable, and this, and you decided to call the Laplacian just with respect to the other variables, and this is normally written this way, which is the wave equation. And we know that the wave equation behaves completely differently to Laplace's equation. There's no reasonable way that you can really treat them together. They're really quite different topics. So I'm going to concentrate on the elliptic equations in this talk, in these lectures. So always, if I forget to say it, from now on, I'm always talking about elliptic operators. Okay, so some more examples. So I don't think I'm going to actually prove much today. Today is more just an introduction, and then you will see whether you want to continue with this course if it interests you. On yes? Yes? Oh, well, no, they don't exhaust the possibilities at all. You could allow one eigenvalue to be zero here, and you get the heat equation. You could allow the main, if you allow x dependence here, you could allow it to change from being positive definite to having mixed, having some positive eigenvalue, some negative eigenvalue, so the type of equation changes. So, and all those things, they can have very different behaviors. Well, there might be. I don't know, actually. I think there are results. I don't know that much about the sort of strange, all the strange possibilities, but I know that there's certainly a great deal of work where this matrix is degenerate, where it's sort of non-negative definite, and you have degeneracies, and there's a lot of work on that. And there is also some work on situations where it changes from being positive definite to negative definite, to having one eigenvalue negative, so it changes from elliptic to hyperbolic, that sort of thing. There's work on that. Those problems tend to be very difficult because at the transition, the equation is sort of degenerating. So they're difficult problems to deal with. Okay, well, we can generalize this a little bit more. So what are we up to? Three. Maybe this is three here. We could allow the coefficients here to depend not just on x, but also on the solution and its gradient. We can write that in this way. So all this other stuff we just simply collect into one term here. And that equations like that are called quasi-linear. Okay, and the definition of ellipticity extends in a more or less obvious way. So this equation 2 is elliptic. So now, with respect to U, or U is an elliptic solution, or some such thing, if Aij x u du is, this matrix is positive definite. at each point of omega. And there, you see, because the matrix depends on U and the gradient, you have to say elliptic with respect to U, or U is an elliptic solution, because it may be elliptic on some solutions and not on others. There may be functions for which the ellipticity degenerates and it becomes hyperbolic, for example. So, you know, you can easily cook up examples like that. Okay, so that's sort of the next step in complexity. And finally, you have fully nonlinear equations where it's nonlinear possibly with respect to even the second derivative. So we call these fully nonlinear. Okay, and some examples here. Well, maybe if I come back to the quasi-linear case. So up till about 20 years ago, fully nonlinear equations weren't studied very much. There were some special cases that were studied, but most of the theory concerned quasi-linear equations. Maybe I'll say a little bit about where quasi-linear equations come from and give some examples. So although in this course I'll concentrate mostly on fully nonlinear equations, along the way we'll get some results for quasi-linear equations as well. And also for linear equations, for that matter. Okay, so one source of quasi-linear problems is the calculus of variations. So let's say we're given a function f from Rn to R. Let's say it's reasonably nice, let's say smooth. And we look at some functional. So you get it by, say, integrating over the domain omega the function f. Which makes sense for, say, u, which is c1, say, on the closure of the domain. So C1 in the interior, so continuously differentiable in the interior, and the derivatives extend continuously to the boundary. And so you can ask about minimizing this. The problem, minimize I in the class, say, V in C1 omega, such that V is some given function, what do we call it? Say U0 on the boundary. Okay? Now, suppose we have a minimizer. Suppose we can solve this problem. I'm not saying under what conditions we can or how we go about it, but let's just assume. Suppose U is a minimizer. So what does that mean? That means that I of U is bigger than or equal to I of V for all V in this class. Let's call it capital V. Okay? So what you expect, if things are nice, this is a nice smooth function, that you should have I for any function, let's say eta, which is V1 and which has compact support in omega, so that's what that means. So that, what does that mean? That means eta is equals zero outside a compact subset of omega. Then what you expect is that if you look at I plus epsilon eta minus I of U, and then you, well, no. If you, if it's going to have a minimum at U, then you expect that if you differentiate this with respect to epsilon and set epsilon equal to zero, that this should be zero. Right? Right? If the function has a minimum at U, then the first derivative of I should be zero, then that is what that means. And if you compute this, what do you get? Well, you just do the computation, you get that this is equal to F. So if I denote partial derivative with respect to the gradient variable, you get U plus epsilon d eta. Inside, then you get derivative with respect to epsilon. So you get di eta outside. And then when you set epsilon equal to zero, this part disappears. So we've got that. So this is equal to zero. And now, if U happens to be C2, so not just once differentiable, but twice differentiable, we can integrate by parts. To get so, and this is true for all eta compact support, so that implies that di of f pi du is equal to zero. Okay, and again, there's a summation here of the repeated i's. Okay, so that gives us a second order PDE. If you write it out, differentiate it out, you get f pi p J of du, dij u is equal to zero. So variational problems like this give rise to quasi-linear equations. If you look at something slightly more general here, instead of f just depending on du, if you look at something a bit more general, then what you get here, you get an extra term, so you get, if I write that in yellow, minus f of u x u d u is equal to 0. And now this would also be xu. Okay, so equations, so variational problems like this give you quasi-linear equations in general. Okay? So a lot of the theory of quasi-linear equations was motivated by this, and there's a sort of a very close relation between that and the calculus of variations. So some examples of equations come up in this way. Well, you could take f of p to be 1 plus p squared, square root of all that. So I of u is given by this, and that is just the area of the graph. Okay, so in this case, so the picture, if I draw a picture, the domain is here. The boundary is some function. So u is equal to u0 on the boundary. And we're looking for a graph which has least area among all graphs which have the same boundary values. And so if you look at what you get here, that gives you the minimal surface equation. Where can I write that? So this is the minimal surface equation. Okay, and if you differentiate this out, see what the coefficient matrix is, you see that you get another way to write the minimal surface equation is you expand it out. So this is the AIJ matrix. And if you look at that, you see that's a positive definite matrix, so the minimal surface equation is an elliptic equation. Okay, so that's one of the equations that fits into this framework. Okay, other interesting equations. Well, you could take f of p equal to some power, and what you get is get an equation which looks like this. Okay, so if alpha is equal to 2, that gives you Laplace's equation. And if alpha is something else, you get something else. All of these problems are interesting, at least for alpha between 1 and infinity. They're all elliptic, possibly degenerate in when alpha is 1. But they're interesting problems that have been studied quite a lot. Okay, if you come back to here, you see you get an elliptic equation exactly when this f is strictly convex with respect to the gradient. Okay, so variational problems like this, where you have something strictly convex with respect to the gradient give you elliptic equations, quasi-linear elliptic equations. Okay, that's probably enough about quasi-linear equations for the moment. This is the P Laplace equation. Usually it's not alpha, but P that's written here. But I've used P for something else already. What are they useful for? I'm not sure what sort of physical phenomena they describe. The case where alpha is 1 is of interest in image processing, or at least the parabolic version, analog of that. So heat equation with Laplacian replaced by that is of some interest there. Also, there's a connection with optimal transport. You can construct optimal maps for in optimal transport. If you look at the cost function that Robert had, was using C for it. C of X and Y is mod X minus Y. You can construct optimal maps for this cost function by studying an equation like this with a suitable right-hand side, F, which is something that is, if you had the two densities, mu was say f dx and nu was g, say dy, then if you put here the function f of x minus g of x, I think, and you look at this P Laplace problem, then by looking at solutions of this and taking limits as alpha goes to infinity, you can extract enough information from these solutions to construct optimal maps for this optimal transportation problem. So that's another application. And I think there are other models. Collapsing sand piles, right? Involve this? Yes, and the parabolic analogs. The elliptic one, I'm not sure exactly. I mean, I can't think of exactly offhand what application. Yes. Well, although I can't think of all the applications offhand, I think there are quite a few applications. Okay, so now, fully nonlinear equations. Well, Robert already mentioned one example. That's the Monge-Ampere equation. And that sort of one of the most important examples, that's possibly the first fully nonlinear equation that was studied. So we saw one application already, that the potential function, if the cost is quadratic, then the potential function plus 1/2 x squared satisfies a Monge-Ampère equation in some sense. Okay, so that's what Robert mentioned on Monday, and so that's sort of the most direct connection between fully nonlinear equations and optimal transport. Okay, what can we say about this? Well, as I said, we're going to talk about elliptic equations here. So what's ellipticity mean here? Well, if you have, let me make another definition. So this fully nonlinear equation is elliptic, or let me state this another way. Some function u, which is say c2, is an elliptic solution of this fully nonlinear equation. If, well, what should, how should we define ellipticity now? There's no matrix anymore. So how should we define it? Well, one way to motivate this is if you look at the linearization right, so you replace u by u plus epsilon t, and then you differentiate this with respect to epsilon and set epsilon equal to zero. What you get is, well, let me write this way, f. So let me use rij to stand for the second derivative variable here, x u du d2u dij phi p plus f pi x u du d2u div plus f u x u du d2u p. Okay, so a reasonable definition of ellipticity here is that you require the linearized equation at u to be elliptic. So that's the definition. So if f r I j x u du d2u is positive definite. In omega. Okay. So what does that mean for the Monge-Ampère equation? Well, if you, this is f, and you differentiate with respect to the second derivatives, what you get is the cofactor matrix. And if the cofactor matrix is positive definite, then all the eigenvalues of d2u have to have the same sign. Okay, and if they all have the same sign, it means that the Hessian is either positive definite or negative definite. So we may as well assume it's positive. So the Monge-Ampère equation is elliptic if D2U is a positive matrix. Okay. And so if we're going to look for elliptic solutions in that case, then this is going to be positive. And so F should be positive. So in that case, for such solutions to exist, we need to assume that the right-hand side is a positive function. Okay. So, if we're going to do elliptic Monge-Ampère equations, we have to solve in the class of convex functions. Okay, what else? Okay, well, various types of Monge-Ampère equations are interesting. One special case that we'll probably talk about in more detail later on is when you have this choice of right-hand side, and then f of x is the Gauss curvature. Of the graph u at x. Okay. So this particular one is very interesting in geometry, in differential geometry. Okay, what other? Well, there are a lot of other Monge-Ampère equations. We can generalize like this. Instead of putting just the Hessian of U there, we can put another matrix. Let's call it, say, A, X, U, du. So A, that's the metric n by n matrix, which depends on x, u, du. And that sort of equation also comes up in optimal transport. okay, I said up here that if you take this cost function, then the potential function that Robert talked about satisfies the Monge-Ampère equation, provided you add on this, right? So actually, the potential function was phi, then u is phi c plus a half x squared, right? Now, in general, if you take some other cost function, not the quadratic one, you don't get something nice like this. You get something horrible like that, which depends on the gradient of the potential function in some complicated way. It doesn't necessarily depend on x and u, just on the gradient of the potential function. And the matrix depends in some way on the second derivatives of the cost function. Okay, so that's a much more complicated equation to deal with, and basically, as far as applications to optimal transport are concerned, there's almost nothing is known. Only a few special cases. There's a lot of open problems there. Okay, so that's a more complicated Monge-Ampère equation that has connections with optimal transport. These sorts of equations also come up in differential geometry. So optimal transport. Differential geometry. In two dimensions also, isometric embedding problems. Of two-dimensional Riemannian manifolds. So if you don't know about Riemannian manifolds, it doesn't matter. But these sorts of equations have a lot of potential applications if we could solve them. If they weren't so difficult. Right? Yes? Negative Gauss curvature is a tough problem, yes. It depends what you are asking, what sort of result. If you just ask for, say, if f is negative and you just ask for, say, in two dimensions, say, for local solvability, then it's a hyperbolic problem. You get local solvability. If you're asking for more, like solving an initial value problem or something, then there are some results, but it's a much harder problem. And in fact, as far as I know, people working, say, on hyperbolic problems are quite happy looking at things like the wave equation with a nonlinearity on the right. But as far as I know, they haven't decided to look at things like this. Right? They're quite happy just with Laplacian here or things that are not too nonlinear. Right? So maybe there's some non-linearity there, but this is sort of, if you go into hyperbolic equations, things like this still haven't been looked at. Okay, so basically the reason we can do elliptic equations for non-linear things is elliptic equations somewhat easier, which is why we can go a bit further. Okay, some other examples. Well, I guess I better move along, but some other examples which I think are very interesting and have been studied quite a lot. Remember, Laplacian U is the sum of the eigenvalues of the Hessian. Eigenvalues of D2U. Determinant of the Hessian is the product of the eigenvalues. Well, surely these are not the only two interesting functions you can take. There are many others. And some of the others are things like this. You take products of M of these things, eigenvalues, like this. And this gives you corresponding equations. Where this is some complicated sort of operator on the Hessian. You take the m by m principal minors and the sum of those things. And that gives you interesting equations. So when m is 1, you get the Laplacian. When m is n, you get the Monge-Ampère equation. And in between, you have these interesting things. And you don't have to stop there. Why take eigenvalues just as the Hessian? You could take eigenvalues as the Hessian plus a matrix. And all those things are also interesting. For example, if you take the principal curvatures of the graph, you get a whole lot of interesting curvature equations. If you take some other matrix, which is of interest in geometry, you get a whole class of equations that in the last 3-4 years have been studied by geometers very intensively. They're very interested in those equations because they can get some sort of topological information about manifolds out of solving certain types of fully nonlinear equations. So apart from telling you about fully nonlinear equations, I'm also advertising the fact that there are lots of applications of these things and lots of problems. Particularly if you have an interest in sort of analysis with a bit of a geometric flavor, and there are a lot of problems in this area. Okay, well is that a good place to take a break? Probably. Okay, so 5-10 minutes. Is this time okay? I guess it's okay for everyone who's here.
Geometric applications?
I'll try to, yes. Thank you.
What notation FPI FOI?
Oh, that's, I'm using P to stand for the gradient variable, so I differentiate.
So what can you write here? What's the FPI?
So F is a function. In that case, F was a function on Rn. So what I'm using, FPI, really means partial F, D, whatever X are, whatever, I'm using P.
So PI, what's PI?
It stands just for the variable. Whatever it is. I mean, it's a function on Rn.
Yeah.
So, or you could write it DIF DU, but that's sometimes a bit confusing. Well, this is exactly what it means, right? If I call variables here in here, P1 up to PN, then this is what I mean. I take the derivative with respect to PI, and I evaluate it at function du.
But if you do that,
what is the FPI? Well, I mean, usually my functions are defined on something like this. So I'm using x for this part, u, or sometimes z for that part, p for this, and r for that, rather than writing x1 up to x, I don't know, n, whatever, n squared plus n plus 1 plus n, right? It just helps simplify the notation. So when I'm thinking of a function of the gradient, I'll use p's.
Okay, not the
yeah, that's exactly what that is. But it's evaluated not at p, at the vector. It's evaluated at du. So it's df dpi composed with du, if you like, or you know, I mean, it's hard to find a really.
Any textbook?
Yes, I forgot to mention. I'll mention that, yes. I'm not sure, Richard Bellman. So, should I start again? Okay, someone asked me in the break, what's a good book for this? For the fully non-linear stuff, there's a book by Gilbarg and Schrödinger. It's called Elliptic PDE of Second Order, or something like that. And it starts, does all the linear theory, does a whole lot of quasi-linear theory, and in the last chapter, chapter 17, it's fully non-linear equations. Okay, so what I'm aiming to do is sort of bypass a lot of the first 16 chapters and get to that. So that's quite good. I'll be using that. A lot of the stuff I'll also, in the linear theory that we'll need, I think it's in chapter 9. Some of the linear theory. So that's quite good. Then there'll be some notes that I'll try and put up on the web or hand out or something, which I've prepared basically following a lot of this and some other material. the stuff on the Monge-Ampère equation is not really written out in any textbook. There is a little bit in here on the Monge-Ampère equation. Before I start to the next thing, let me just mention a couple other fully nonlinear equations that will sort of come out. We'll get some results about these along the way. The Bellman equation, so if we have a family of elliptic operators like this, then we get a fully nonlinear equation. We take the nth over this class. Okay, so we also have some functions, f alpha. So that gives you a second, yes. How's it fit? Yeah, I don't really think this is a very good book to learn the stuff from. If it's the first time you're encountering it, I don't think it's so easy to read. The reason is that they're interested in proving a lot of the results not for solutions which are C2, but working with so-called viscosity solutions. And that introduces a lot of technical complications, which may sort of make it hard to read. So I suggest, if you haven't seen much PDE before, it's probably better to start with here and look at the C2 solutions and then see, because the proofs do change and the technically it's more complicated. So that's the Bellman equation. That's another example. So after the Monge-Ampère equation, this was the other fully nonlinear equation that was studied. And that's elliptic if each of these operators is elliptic. And so this sort of equation comes up in stochastic control theory. Okay, then if you have a family of elliptic operators indexed by two parameters. And you have some functions f alpha beta. Then you can look at this equation. So you take the inf and then sup, so sup alpha in A, beta in B. And that's the Isaacs equation. That comes up in stochastic games theory. So, more applications of fully nonlinear PDE. I won't say anything about much about Isaacs equation in this course. Bellman equation, well, if you think about this, you see it's an inf of linear operators and an inf of linear functions is concave. So these operators are concave with respect to first, second derivatives, solution u. On the other hand, if you have an equation like this, where f is concave, then a concave function can be written as an inf of linear things, right? So this can be written as in this way, and you have to identify exactly what this class of coefficients is, but the point is, if you have a concave operator, something that depends, say, on the second derivative in a concave, then actually you can write it as a Bellman equation. So Bellman equations actually cover a lot of things which we don't normally think of as Bellman equations. So the Monge-Ampère equation if we're looking on concave on convex functions, this is convex is concave rather if d2u is non-negative, and if that's concave then we can write that it's and it's the inf of matrices Aij which are positive, and I probably won't get the number right, but the determinant of Aij, I think it's one over n to the n or some number anyway. So the Monge-Ampère equation is a special case of Bellman equation. And a lot of the early work on, or some of the early work on Monge-Ampère equation was to rewrite it as a Bellman equation and get results that way. Okay, that's sort of the theories developed so far now that that's sort of all been superseded. We don't need to do that anymore. But that was one approach. So Bellman equations really, they're very general. Very general. Krylov Lyons. And most of the equations we'll look at will be concave with respect to second derivative. So this Bellman structure is sort of implicit there. Okay, that's sort of the equation. Now, what I want to do next is a review of linear theory. So, for those who haven't done any PDE before, or very little, you can find all of what I'm going to describe in Gilbard and Schrödinger, chapters 2 to 6 or something like that. Okay, now, don't worry if you don't understand it. I mean, you should be worried if you don't understand the statement. But don't worry if you've never seen any proofs. You don't need to know what the proofs are. I'll just state these results. And that's where we're going to start. So if you want to, you can go back and fill in this gap if you don't know it. I think Walter will cover some of this stuff in his course eventually, and so you can pick it up there. But we won't actually need the proofs, but we'll just need some of the results. So that's going to be the starting point for the theory. So we're going to look at this linear equation again. In omega. Now we're going to assume uniform ellipticity. Say what that is. So that means that this is positive definite, and they exist lambda and capital lambda greater than 0 such that this quadratic form is bounded above and below in this way. Okay, that's uniform ellipticity. So, roughly speaking, that means that the equation is sort of uniformly second order in all directions. Okay. What else do we need? Other assumption we need, well, and then we have a technical assumption. BI, the coefficients BI are bounded. Eventually, we're also going to assume. Well, yeah, just take everything bounded, okay? Okay, so the first result theorem is the so-called weak maximum principle. And it says the following. Uh, If omega is bounded, C is equal to zero, U is a function which is C2, so twice continuously differentiable in omega, and say continuous up to the boundary, and L of U is non-negative, non-negative in omega, then the soup, or the maximum, if you like, the U is bounded by the soup of U over the boundary. If C is less than or equal to zero, then the soup of U in omega is bounded by the soup over the boundary of U plus, where U plus is the maximum of U and zero. Okay, and if L of U is less than zero, then you get sort of corresponding statements to the minimum, which I won't state. So the proof. Okay, so first of all, suppose first of all that has anyone not seen this? Or does anyone admit to not seeing this? It's okay if you haven't. Okay, so suppose first that L of U is strictly positive. Then what have we got? We've got at an interior maximum, say x0, and what do we have? Well, the gradient is zero, and the second derivative matrix, so the maximum, is that way, so it's less than or equal to zero. So L of U, Aij, Dij U, plus Di, Di U, well, this part is zero. The assumption is that that's positive. Now here we've got something which is a positive matrix multiplied by a matrix which is negative. The product could be anything, but in particular the trace of it is non-negative. This is the trace of A, where A is this matrix, times D2U, and that is less than zero. Right, you've got a positive matrix, a matrix which is non-positive. The trace of the product is less than or equal to zero, and we have a contradiction there. Therefore, no interior maximum. Okay. Now, how do we remove this assumption? If L of U is just non-negative rather than positive, we consider U plus, well, you bump it a little bit by something. So epsilon e to the kx1, let's say, and you compute L of U let's consider that U epsilon, where you get L of U, then you get an epsilon and when you differentiate this twice, you'll get A11 there, and A11 is bounded from below by lambda, so this is positive. Sorry? Well, there should be some k's here. Plus bi x1. Okay, so you see you've got a k squared here, you've got a k there. This is bigger than or equal to lambda. So if you fix k large, this term is going to be bigger than that term. If k is large enough. Okay. An epsilon bigger than zero, of course. So now you apply the maximum principle to U epsilon, then let epsilon go to zero. Proof of the maximum principle. If C is less than or equal to zero, if C is not zero, but it's negative, non-positive, you write it this way. You call this L tilde, say, and then on the set where U is positive or bigger than zero, you have you still have the inequality. So. Over the boundary of the set omega intersect set where U is bigger than zero. So that gives you the second statement here. So that's the weak maximum principle. Well, that's the weak maximum principle, so obviously there must be a strong maximum principle. So again, we have LU greater than or equal to zero in omega. This time has to be connected, but not necessarily bounded in this case. C is equal to zero. So if U attains its maximum in omega in the interior, then U is constant in omega. Okay, if C is less than or equal to zero and C over lambda or C is bounded, then you cannot have non-negative. Maximum in omega unless it is constant. Okay, and the proof of that. So I suppose the maximum of U is M, and U equals M somewhere in omega, but U is not identically M. So the picture looks like this. Here's a domain, and somewhere in here U is equal to M, and somewhere else U is strictly less than M. So then we can find a ball in here. So that it touches at some point. So B is contained in omega intersected with the set where U is less than M, and U at x0 is equal to M for some x0 on the boundary of the ball. Okay, so what do we have? So in here we have U is less than M. Here we have U of x0 is equal to M. And the claim, so what we need is a lemma which says that if we look at the outward normal derivative of U at x0, this is outward normal derivative with respect to the ball, that this must be positive. And that gives a contradiction. Well, here we need x0 to be inside the domain as well, because you see x0 is a maximum point. So at a maximum point, a maximum point of U means that du at x0 is equal to zero. So if we can prove this, then we have a contradiction. Okay, and how do we prove that? Well, we build a comparison function which looks something like this. We look at V is e to the minus alpha x squared minus e to the minus alpha r squared. We look at that in Vr minus Vr over 2. So we're looking in the annular region here. So compute L of B. Okay, so what do you get? You get some exponential stuff. When you differentiate that twice, you get an alpha squared, Aij, Xi, Xj, probably a 4, plus alpha, Aij, delta Ij, that's a 2. Minus, probably, minus 2 alpha bi xi. Okay, so if you choose this alpha large, what have you got here? Well, we're looking in the annular region, so x is bounded away from 0. Bigger than r over 2 mod x. So if alpha is large, remember it's a uniformly elliptic equation, so Aij we have that. So this is bounded by lambda r over 2 squared minus 2 alpha n times lambda minus some constant times alpha times r. Okay, so if alpha is large, this is the dominant term and the whole thing is non-negative. Alpha is large. Okay, now on the boundary of the ball, V is equal to 0, and on the inner boundary, U minus epsilon V is less than 0, if epsilon bigger than 0 is small. Okay, check, I'll get this right. U minus M. Okay, so V is positive. U minus M, well, the only place where U is as big as M is here on the boundary, elsewhere it's strictly less than M. So if we stay on this boundary here, we get something negative still if we make this epsilon small enough. So if we call this V epsilon, or U epsilon, we have L of U epsilon non-negative, and it has its minimum, maximum. U epsilon is less than or equal to 0 on the boundary of the annulus. So it must be less than or equal to zero in the whole annulus. And therefore, if it's less than or equal to zero in the whole annulus and it's equal to zero somewhere on the boundary at x0, then the outward normal derivative there of u epsilon at x0 must be less than zero inside zero there, so it must be non-negative, which means that the normal derivative of u at x0 is bigger than minus epsilon times the normal derivative of v at x0, which is positive. Okay, so that's the proof of the strong maximum principle. Okay. So there are two bits of linear theory we need. The other linear theory that we need is the Schauder theory, and that one will not prove. I'll state it and explain a little bit about it, but I won't give the proofs. So again, now we've got, I have to talk a little bit about the Hölder spaces. Suppose we have function, which is say continuous in omega. We say, so alpha, say let's take it between 0 and 1. We say that u belongs to C0 alpha, say omega on the closure, if sup u of x minus u of y over x minus y the alpha, x and y in omega, x not equal to y, if this is finite. Okay? And usually we write this thing here. We write it in that way. So C0 alpha omega bar is a Banach space. And the norm is given by say U0 alpha omega. It's simply the sup of U over omega plus this so-called Hölder seminal. Okay, and similarly, if u is in Ck omega, so we have k times continuously differentiable, then u is in Ck alpha omega bar if the kth order derivatives are Hölder continuous. So if this is finite. And it's also a Banach space. And the norm, K alpha omega, is you take the K, the jth order derivatives, you take the sup over omega, and then you sum from j equals 1 up to j equals 0 up to k, and then you add on the alpha semi-norm of the kth order derivatives. And that's a Banach space as well. Okay, why do we need these spaces? Well, basically, to do elliptic PDE, the spaces CK, where K is an integer, are not really well suited for the theory. These spaces are much better. And, well, maybe when I state the next result, it'll be become clearer why. Okay, so now our assumptions are going to be like this. Aij, one more thing. So we have a domain omega. It's bounded. We say omega, or the boundary, is in CK alpha. Say K bigger than 1, alpha between 0 and 1. If for each x0 on the boundary there exists a CK alpha diffeomorphism of omega intersect some ball, say BR, x0, closure, onto a half space, onto, say, a ball, B capital R, say y0. So the picture is like this. Okay. So we take x0, take a ball about there. There is a diffeomorphism which flattens that. So it maps this to here. So what do we call this diffeomorphism? Capital V. And the diffeomorphism P and inverse is assumed to be CK alpha. So that's the technical definition of what it means for a domain to have this sort of regularity. Okay, we're getting there. So now we're going to look at a domain omega with boundary of class C to alpha. From now on, alpha is between 0 and 1, not equal to 1. Coefficients and the function f are continuous in omega bar, with exponent, holder exponent alpha. an Aij bigger than lambda psi squared for all, well, and there exists some lambda bigger than zero such that this is true for all. Okay, and finally we have function phi, which is phi 2 alpha omega. If U in C2 omega bar is any solution of LU equals F in omega, U equals C on the boundary, then the 2 alpha norm of U is controlled by, say, the sup of U plus the alpha norm of F plus the 2 alpha norm of T. Where C depends on N, depends on lambda, depends on alpha, depends on the domain, and depends on capital lambda, where this is some bound for the alpha norm of the coefficients. Okay, so if you have any solution of this problem where the coefficients satisfy these conditions, they have a certain amount of regularity, then any solution has any solution which is in C2 is C2 alpha, and it satisfies this bound. It's controlled by the maximum of the solution plus the alpha norm of the right-hand side plus the 2 alpha norm of the boundary condition. And since, and this is an optimal sort of thing, you see, it's a second order equation. So if this is C alpha, you see, we sort of gain roughly, if you differentiate twice to go backwards, you have to integrate twice. So you expect you gain 2 degrees of differentiability. Well, there it is, that's the 2. So you gain 2 degrees of differentiability there, and the solution is as smooth as the boundary data. Okay? So that's what that estimate says. And I want to emphasize this estimate is true only for alpha, strictly between 0 and 1. It's not true at the endpoints. If you put alpha equal to 0, you don't gain 2 derivatives. Or if you put alpha equal to 1, it's also not true. You don't gain 2 derivatives if you just have something which is continuous here. So the Hölder spaces are good for elliptic PDE theory because if you work in those spaces, you gain 2 derivatives, as you sort of expect you should. Okay, that's the Schauder estimate. I'll just state the final result, and that'll be it for today. The second part, if C is less than or equal to zero, then this problem star has a unique solution U in C2 alpha omega bar. Okay, so if C is negative, then we also have existence, the unique solution. So the uniqueness part follows from the maximum principle. If you have two solutions, then the difference satisfies the equation with zero right-hand side and zero in the boundary, on the boundary, right? Because it's a linear equation. And by the maximum principle, that must have its maximum on the boundary and its minimum on the boundary. So it must be zero, so there's only one solution. Okay, and you get existence. Okay, so that's pretty much all the linear theory I'm going to assume. To prove this would take probably a couple of lectures because there's quite a lot of machinery. It basically comes down to the corresponding results for Laplace's equation. And for Laplace's equation, you have a formula for the solution. So if you define gamma of x is n 2 minus n omega n mod x to the 2 minus n, n is bigger than 3, bigger than or equal to 3, and 1 over 2 pi log x for n equal to 2, then the solution of this problem you can write as a couple of integrals. F of y gamma over x minus y plus some boundary integrals. Like that. Okay. So now if you replace gamma by gamma plus h, where h is a harmonic function, then what you can arrange, if you call this gamma tilde, you just get gamma tildes here, and if you choose the harmonic function right, you can make this term be zero by making gamma tilde zero on the boundary. And so you have a formula for the solution in terms of the right-hand side and the value on the boundary, phi. Okay? And you have this function here is more or less explicitly given. So the estimate comes basically, you simply write it out. You take two derivatives of this, you estimate the Hölder norm and do a lot of computation, and what you get. It's explicit. Okay? although it is quite tedious and it's not completely trivial how you do it, but in principle, there's a formula. From the formula, you write out the estimate. Okay? Okay, and so to get this, it's basically an argument. If you can solve this, then you can deform the solution of this to a solution of that by a continuity method. Okay? Which I don't have time to explain now. But that's the theory. So that's basically all the linear theory we need for the moment. So what I'm going to do next is talk about how you solve non-linear equations. I'll do that next week. And you'll see that you need a bunch of a priori estimates. And then I'll start the long, tedious process of proving some of those a priori estimates. And in the end, we'll be able to solve things like Monge-Ampère equations. Okay, thank you.